sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
September 11th, we remember, and we'll never forget. Volatility spikes as markets plunge. Apple announces new products, and the Fed decision is weeks away. What we need to know. And finally, an important discussion about risk facing bond and fixed income investors. All this and much more on episode number 475 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast time. Time to talk about investing, finance, talk about money, markets, economics, earnings, all sorts of things that will hopefully help you make some money and continue being a successful investor. We have a good amount of things to talk about today. Of course, it's today is September 11th on Sunday, and we do remember, of course, that horrible event so many years ago that is still fresh in our minds, terror that struck New York and all of the world, actually, in that terrible situation. And it's not much more you can say about it, but I did watch the ceremonies this morning, and it was nice to see around town, actually, all the various fire stations and police stations were in full garb and paying tribute to all those brave people who had fallen during that terrible day. But we also have markets to talk about, of course, and some things that we need to get to. I wanted to also mention before we began that we have a new system, something easy, something that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why we didn't do it a long time ago. But basically, if you want to ask a question, you know, you used to say, oh, hey, just send an email to Ask Andrew, blah, 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 all that stuff. You can still do so, of course, at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But right on the disciplinedinvestor.com website, there's a little button at the top there, a little area on the top navigation menu where you can just click. It says Ask Andrew a Question. And you click there, you just submit your question that way, much easier to deal with. And if you have any questions on finance, you have any questions on investments, on any topic about sectors, the world economy, whatever it may be, I'll be happy to answer and hopefully answer on the show as well on an episode that comes up soon. Some of the questions we won't get to on the air, but I will definitely answer them back to you in an email personally. So feel free to use that new and improved process to ask any questions that you have. Well, let's talk a little bit about what happened in terms of economics. Of course, we know that the markets, well, didn't do so well last week. As a matter of fact, Friday was one of the ugliest days in months. Volume spiked, volatility spiked, so almost a 400 drop in the Dow. But let's go back and set the stage for a second with what went on in terms of how we led up to this exact point and maybe do a little bit of a deconstruction on what caused some of that and what led up to this. The first thing we got to talk about is clearly that we saw two bits of information over the last week and a half, and it was related to the manufacturing and the non-manufacturing or the service index that's put out by ISM, the Institute for Supply Management. Now, the first thing we saw about a week and a half ago was that the manufacturing component of the ISM, which is about 30% of our overall economy, was under 50, which means that the way they measure this is simply 50 is the zero line, we'll call it. Over 50 is expansionary. Under 50 is contraction. So just to make it really easy, over 50 is good, under 50 is not so good. And of course, we have to look at this on a rolling basis and over time and see how the trend is going and what's happening. But essentially speaking, that if we're under 50, oftentimes that is a precursor to a concern about recessionary times. Because when you see contraction along with slow or anemic GDP, you have to wonder what's happening in there. But really, you want to put both of those together. You want to look at both the manufacturing and the non-manufacturing or the service index. Now, the service index came in very disappointing. Came in at 51.4 in August, which is about 4 points below the July reading. Now, it's been expanding for about 79 consecutive months, but this is the slowest rate of expansion in over 6 years, since February of 2010. And it was the largest monthly drop in this particular index since November of 2008. Now, why is that? There's a lot of things that go into that. It could be that there was some concern over the Brexit that kind of was holding off for a while. All of a sudden, the vote came, and now people are a little bit antsy about things. Can't be necessarily that people are really that concerned about their job and job security, because we're seeing that, you know, generally speaking, jobs are being added. The unemployment rate is low. Interest rates are still low. But clearly in the economy, when we look behind the numbers of just the GDP, just employment, or just inflation, which are three key areas that the Feds look at, something underneath this is not doing so well. We already saw that, you know, we saw this major increase in auto sales for years, and it seemed to have peaked out recently and it's starting to slow down. We know that the housing market has still been pretty strong. Overall, we're seeing some of the highest levels that we've seen in years, back to, in many areas, the pricing that was at the peak before the crash in the mid-2000s, 2006 at the height, 7 at the height, and then, you know, after 2008, 2009, when things just got chopped, and then it's finally starting to recover back to peak pricing. Some areas in the country clearly are over the top, and there's some areas that are still stagnating, haven't really returned much from the levels, we'll call it pre-crisis. Now, the Beige Book, which is the report that's put out by the Fed, this is kind of a precursor usually to their monthly rate meetings and their minutes that they put out. This is looking at each individual region in terms of how they've done, and then each region puts out their report, and then it comes together. It's called the Beige Book. And the interesting thing is that when you look at the Beige Book, you're seeing that many of the participants that provided information, this is the various various regional bank, Federal Reserve banks, et cetera, they said that the economic activity in the 12 districts was fairly modest. Wage growth was something that was really concerning them. Little improvement in wage growth looking ahead. So we're seeing that while we have what everybody believes to be full employment, something's missing. Usually with low interest rates, you would think that with low interest rates and with generally an unemployment rate at 4.9 or 5%, people being added regularly, the initial claims numbers, you know, down very significantly, the lowest we've seen in decades on a weekly basis, you would think that there'd be some kind of wage pressure, but it's not happening. The wage pressure really has been mostly for highly skilled workers. But the problem is that employers also have been very having a hard time filling job vacancies in IT, engineering, and in construction. So in other words, we don't have those people within our economy that are skilled in certain areas. And maybe some of these areas are the ones that would, in fact, help create wage pressure and increase wages, because there's still a lot of openings out there, particularly in IT, which I find very interesting. So there's this very distinct separation of what is going on in the economy compared to unemployment. And when we look at unemployment, there's a very distinct question as to, well, if we have all these people being added to the payrolls and things look good, how come there's no wage pressure? And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the fact that we are still in an environment where technology is taking away many of the jobs that were before utilized for certain positions. So no longer, I've used this before, you probably heard me talk about this, but no longer do we have a need for factory workers to be maybe manufacturing a particular, I don't know, let's say a car. So instead of that, they've replaced it with robots, automation. You have no longer the need for certain jobs entirely. For example, maybe a receptionist, maybe a file clerk. Those are handled from various technology that has voicemail and has automated attendance and has a phone system that maybe can direct through a tree of messaging systems directly to a particular party. So no longer do you have to have a whole bank of receptionists at a big company answering phones continually. A file clerk maybe is not necessary because you have a scanner and you have a centralized filing system at a place of business. And now all of a sudden, instead of asking for a particular file, maybe you're a law firm, instead of doing that, well, now you have all of a sudden the ability to bring it up on your screen instantaneously. So that is a change in the dynamic. Maybe there's a whole team of people that aren't needed anymore to do something. Now you may need people to do scanning, but even that, many of these companies have automated systems where when mail comes in, it's basically opened, shoved into a scanner, pushed into the right particular job number and tracked that way. So again, a lot of areas of our economy have changed dramatically over the years due to technology. You could probably go down a scenario for almost every company and think of what particular area has been transformed. And it's continuing. Look at just the concept of something we didn't even think about just a few years ago, which is autonomous vehicles. No longer needing someone to actually drive. And what does that mean? Well, we talked about this a number of shows ago. One of the most fascinating episodes of The Disciplined Investor, I think, in a long time. We had someone on talking about the whole autonomous vehicle, the future of autonomous driving, and how now your car, while maybe you're sleeping, maybe at work, not using it, can be used to drive other people. And you could possibly have that as an adjunct to your income, or even you don't even need a car anymore. You just have a car pick you up that's passing by on the way somewhere, and the computers will route the most efficient direction and driving route, and then just drop you off. And maybe you're just part of a simple lease program of it. Now, what does that mean? Who does that leave out? Well, your Uber drivers are gone. Maybe buses are history. Trains, we'll see about that. But what about all the truckers? What about all the truckers that are employed driving things across the country? So they may be eliminated. So while other jobs are created by the advancement of technology, and specifically the jobs of creating the technology, monitoring it and upgrading it, distribution of it, installation, implementation, the fact is still there's something to be said about how technology can cause what we're talking about right here, which is the lack of wage pressure. Because if there is wage pressure, maybe a company says, you know what? Before we pay people more money to do that job and bring on more people necessarily, let's see if there's a technology solution that we can find that maybe will require less people, because then we have to pay less taxes, we have to pay less vacation pay, we have to pay less health insurance and benefits, et cetera, and all the different problems that go along with having employees, those pesky employees, okay? You know, I mean, this is what a company's thinking. So maybe there's something to be said there, and I think this is going to be on the table in the next few years as something that we're going to have to look at on the effect of how the underlying economics are really affected by this. Let's continue on. Let's talk about oil and gold. Now, fascinating week for oil. So oil was still up about 3.5% for the week, even though it dropped about 3.7% or so on Friday. Finished just below $46, about $45.88 a barrel on Friday. And actually, gold is up also for the week. One of the things that was really interesting last week was the continuation of the discussions by Iran and Russia and various OPEC members and non-OPEC members about stabilizing the price or doing something, whether it's production cuts, production freezes, or something else that they may do to actually stabilize prices of oil, because obviously the longer oil stays, I will say below 50 clearly, but in the 40s, the more difficult it is for many companies to continue existing because they're not making money on the production. So we did see over the last few weeks that there has been a lot of rhetoric and a lot of discussion trying to prop up the price of oil from Russia and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And then what was most interesting was on Wednesday when, oh no, this week was Thursday, pardon me, because we had a short week last week, right? So on Thursday, when the official numbers came out in terms of inventories, how much was either drawn or increased in terms of the overall inventories, there was a gigantic drawdown, about 14 million barrels, one of the biggest drawdowns I've seen in a long time. And that caused a major spike in the price of oil. Remember something, we have a lot of people on the short side and continuing to get short. You get spooked out every once in a while with all this discussion from various parties about oil. And of course, there is some relationship with the dollar and oil. And as the dollar moves higher or lower, it kind of it does affect oil a bit, especially for us here, because oil is priced in dollars. But probably one of the most interesting things is when we're starting to see a change in the supply. Now, whether or not there was some relationship that was between what was talked about earlier in the week with Russia and, again, a few other parties in Saudi Arabia the week before about trying to stabilize the price of oil and the amount that was drawn down. In other words, there was lack of production from a few different places, or maybe the refiners from various places really sucked out a lot of oil to produce gasoline. Whatever it may be, there was still an interesting change in the dynamic of the growth of inventories, because we've been seeing a growth for a long time. And on top of that, as oil recently topped in the high 40s into 50, dollar range, you saw that many more rigs were added. We've been seeing that all those idled rigs on a weekly basis, which we get a report on each and every Friday in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock on Friday. We're seeing that there was more rigs that were put back to work. And with that in mind, you would have thought that there'd be a much greater increase in inventories rather than such a substantial drawdown. So I'd watch oil right now. Obviously, the pressure on Friday with the dollar coming up so dramatically, and we'll talk about that in a second, why that happened, had something to do with it. But nonetheless, there was still a pretty good bid under gold. I think that had to do with the volatility and the concern about markets. But oil also had a relatively good week. So maybe there's something changing there that we need to be aware of. Now, so the big question is, what happened on Friday? I mean, you know, that was... Not only was it a down day, but it started out down and wouldn't stop throughout the day and even into the after hours after the close of the regular market on Friday. There was still a drawdown. Well, some of it's being blamed on Boston's Fed president, Eric Rosengren, who came out with, a warning that the economy could overheat if central banks want to continue and wait much longer to raise interest rates, if they're continuing with their low interest rate in market. So that was on the heels of the day before, on Thursday, when Mario Draghi came out with his official rate announcement meeting and decided not to do anything and even discussed that there was a reduced possibility of further stimulus efforts for the European Union. Now, everybody has been used to Mario Draghi coming out with bombshells. You know, every time that he talks, the euro drops. He does something to talk about the potential for maybe we'll expand into this in the future. In other words, continuing to throw a carrot out there for investors and for markets, looking at how they're going to continue with some kind of, you know, stimulus program and really not pull the rug out. But this time, he talked about how, well, I'm not sure. We may not do anything further for a long period of time. Now, I don't know if he did that to set the stage so that in the future he could just go in with another bombshell. But on that news on Thursday, we saw that the euro spiked. The yen spiked. The dollar came in, turned around midday, and didn't really seem to have much of a significant move if you factor in the entire day, but there was an interesting move in the early part of the morning. Now, on the heels of that, we see that Rosengren, who has been rather dovish over time, makes this commentary, which is on the heels of several other speakers of the Fed being a bit more hawkish. And now the countdown for the Fed meeting is only, within 2 weeks for the September rate hike meeting, if in fact that happens. They're meeting on the 20th and the 21st. I believe on the 21st, they're going to come out with a commentary. I think it's the 21st. But anyway, let's just kind of go over what's happening next week. Then I want to get into further discussion about what's going on with the markets here and some of my other takes on what's happening with markets and where the drop came from and what to look for. But coming up this week, we have not much on Monday and Tuesday, really no economic numbers or important speeches or Fed commentary that is scheduled, at least. On Wednesday, you have a couple of players that are coming out with earnings, Analogic and Cracker Barrel. Some other earnings in there. But we have on Thursday, when we start with August retail sales. Now, that will be important to look at because there's been already a concern that things are slowing down and retail sales have been tepid at best. Last month was better than it was expected. But the big question is going to be, what do we have in the future? And if, in fact, the ISM services index fell so dramatically, what's going to happen there? Now, the last couple of months, we saw some nice earnings reports out of Macy's and Dillard's and Kohl's and a variety of the other big box retailers, and very mixed numbers out of the smaller retailers. And the big question is going to be, moving forward, is there something more that meets the eye here? Was the actual numbers that we saw out of the big box retailers doing everything they can to bring up earnings with share buybacks and with inventory reductions and sales, et cetera? What's actually going on with retail sales? We're going to see that next week. We're also going to see the producer price index and a new initial claims report. Earnings that day, Oracle and Progressive. Now, on Friday, the August consumer price index arrives, and that's going to be, of course, very important when we're looking at what the Fed is thinking. Do we have inflation or not? At least by the official metrics. So we'll see a little bit of a peek into that with the PPI and then the CPI. And then finally, we're going to be seeing the preliminary University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. So all those things, if you really think about the importance of this, so we have the retail investor or the retail shopper, consumer. We have a lot of things about the consumer here on the heels of the ISM Service Index and the ISM Manufacturing Index. And then we have the two other important issues. We have a Consumer Confidence Index and we have CPI, which factors into the Fed's decision. So I think there's going to be, towards the end of the week in particular, people are going to be really watching what goes on with markets. In terms of the markets, the S&P fell 2.5% for the day. On Friday, for the week, it fell 2.39%. The NASDAQ down 2.3%, and the Dow off by 2.2%. So that kind of goes through some of that. Now, I think it's important to have a quick discussion about, what went on moving into Friday. So we talked about some of that, but let's get down a little bit more because I think it deserves a look into the psychology of investors and really what played out here. So if you recall last week on this show and on DH Unplugged, of course, you got to listen to DH Unplugged with myself and John C. Dvorak each and every week. Come talk about things on Tuesday night and about 11 o'clock, 10:30 Eastern. On Tuesdays, we produce the show and send it out and available to listen. And also, of course, you can grab that on iTunes or over on dhunplug.com. If you follow me on Twitter, which is Andrew Horowitz, one word, Andrew Horowitz on Twitter, you'll get the latest update when it happens. As soon as it's published, bang, it hits Twitter. So you'll have that available. But last week we discussed something important, an important dynamic that could in fact change how volatility and volume played out on markets. And what was that? Simple. Traders are back from their summer breaks. They're back from their vacations, back from the Hamptons beach parties. And clearly volume and volatility could pick up, we thought. Well, that did happen. Now, to be fair, I didn't think it was going to be that much volatility. I mean, that was a little bit over the top on Friday where we saw that major spike. But this was actually a 70% increase in the VIX for the week, closing at about $17.50. Now, of course, you know, I've always looked at about $15 on the VIX as kind of like, that's a normal, you know, kind of market, even in a boring phase. But we got down in the 11s again. And each time we seem to get down there for a prolonged period of time, something happens. Now, it doesn't have to be dramatic, but at least a little bit of a break of the markets. But recently, the breaks have been so shallow. The upside has been shallow as well. We haven't seen a 1% before this. We haven't seen a 1% move on a daily basis for like 2 months, 3 months. That's not normal. Now, let's talk about a few minutes about the setup and what's going on. First, we had, because of this tight range that we just talked about and the limited volatility and the fact that every dip was bought, it could have been a 0.5%, it could have been 30 basis points, it could be 10 basis points, and the Pavlovian response of markets off of the open. If you haven't noticed, 9:30, the bell rings, and what happens? The buying starts for at least a few minutes. I mean, in a big way. You see big spikes in the futures and the SPY and ETFs and various stocks. Everything starts moving very dramatically right off the open. Bad news is now good news. We have accommodative central banks, ultra-low yields, a general level of complacency is out there. And let's not forget about, if you're watching any kind of media related to business and markets, the bulls are everywhere, making excuses for valuations and looking at the fact that things are going to get better, and don't worry about a low GDP, and don't worry about the Fed, they're staying on hold. Now, when we continue on looking at this, let's start with the fact that the general backdrop has been this kind of low movement of markets, and again, low volatility and complacency. But why is that? I mean, what's going on? So we have, first of all, a bit of a brainwashing by central banks. I mean, I guess it has to be called, if you want to get sophisticated, we could call it a market psychology lesson and implementation of various behavioral finance to train market participants that the Fed will always be there if markets start getting in trouble. Forget about the economics behind it. We're just talking about markets now. People have been focusing on the fact that, you know, already that, well, if the market dropped 400 points, that means that the Fed is definitely not going to raise in September. It's the third leg of the Fed's mandate, which is not official, to have markets maintain order. But remember something. One of the things that's happening with central banks is they're going off the rails. We got negative interest rates and ultra easy monetary policy is clearly forcing a mispricing of risk. And on top of that, a mispricing of valuations. We also have an earnings yield and the actual yield on stocks. So you look at the earnings yield, which is the inverse, and compare that along a couple of metrics. And the actual yield on stocks, more importantly, is higher than safe fixed income products. We look at the belly of the curve and long maturities. And this is kind of what's been inspiring the TINA philosophy. There is no alternative. This is nothing else to do. Why should I buy a bond that is 1% for, let's say, a 5-year period, or even 2% in some cases, maybe on a 10 or 15 year period, when I can have a 2.5% stock or a 3% stock? Forgetting, of course, about volatility, because there has not been any volatility. We've seen, though, 5 consecutive quarters of earnings and revenue declines for the S&P 500. Clearly, this is what is technically known as an earnings recession. But that's being hyped and hoped away. This is where the media has allowed for the bullish camp to come out and continually say, don't worry about that. You know, remember something that one of the big things they're talking about is, oh, well, things are going to get better. Well, of course they're going to get better. If you think about it for a second, unless things really get ugly, let's just say that there is basically no growth off of the next couple of quarters of earnings. But you have to look back to how they compare that. They're comparing that for a year ago period. So now if we have five quarters of consecutive earnings decline, we're already in a phase right now where we're comparing to very low numbers. And if we're comparing to very low numbers, the chances for us to look a little bit better in terms of earnings, even if there's not a lot of growth, and even if it's off a very low base, is going to look better. And then the comparisons are going to say, well, look at that. We got 2% growth. Well, you have 2% growth from a year ago after you fell down so much. That's not really that good. Now, of course, when you get into a true recessionary environment, which I'm not saying we're in or really at this point, it's very hard to say that we're in that scenario. We don't have negative GDP at this point. While we have contraction in the ISM, okay. Service is still going okay. Housing is still doing fine. Earnings are growing, or at least stabilizing. They're not dropping too hard, a little bit here and there. A lot of it due to the energy sector. Of course, we know that. So the overall, if you take out the energy sector, it's not so bad for most companies. In fact, some companies are doing really well. But understand we're dealing with things off a very low base, off a very low comparison, and that is going to actually help the numbers in the future. They know this, but they're wrapping this in, oh, things are going to get better. We're going to see some growth. Well, again, remember, look at the raw numbers. If you see the numbers continuing of revenues and earnings going down, forget about just necessarily growth. If they're continually moving lower or at least stagnating, that's a problem. And the valuation question. This has been something that has annoyed the crap out of me. You know this. I've talked about this ad nauseum on many episodes. We're well above historical average price earnings multiples when we consider a variety of different ways of calculating it. But this has pretty much been explained away and looked at and ignored to a degree due to the low interest rate environment that we're currently in. And this low interest rate environment says, well, if we have low interest rates as we have it, valuations on stocks are okay to be higher because you have a change in the model where you price and you value a stock. Because people can actually borrow money and invest and leverage up, etc., to buy more stocks, and there's a lot of that going on. But I don't know. I don't know if that's really true. Can we just hope away that they're a lower interest rate environment and things should be a lot better? Or should we just stick to the traditional metrics of looking at earnings growth and a multiple there? Now, clearly, we do know something. We do know that bond yields did rise last week. And there's been a couple of different drivers of that. First of all, Rosengrand clearly talking last week caused bond yields to move a little bit higher. Maybe it was something that was building anyway due to a little bit of more hawkish. And of course, because the ECB is not doing anything, didn't increase their purchases, and probably were in an environment where the Fed, while they may not raise in the near future, well, they may either way, but let's say they don't, they're not increasing their purchases of bonds. They're staying at the same levels. But we do know that one of the main drivers of markets over the last, we'll call it year and a half, 2 years, but maybe the last year especially, in a big way that has stabilized and helped earnings at least to a level has been, you know, share buybacks. And one of the drivers of share buybacks has been lower interest rates. In fact, as lower interest rates have continued for some time, it's allowed for companies to issue more debt. And with that debt, they take in money. And with that money, what they do is they buy back shares, increase their dividends. So now you have a situation where you have low interest rates that make buying a stock more compelling because they've been raising their interest rates on the dividends. And on top of that, you have these share buybacks, which are shrinking the float and therefore bringing in the opportunity for them to have continual growth or at least stabilization of their EPS, earnings per share. The problem is that the debt for companies right now in the U.S. is the highest in record. It is the highest level of overall debt that has been issued in corporate history. And while interest rates are lower than maybe they were 5 years ago, we could say, if interest rates are half of what they were, if they were 5.5%, 6%, now they're, let's say a company's paying 3%, they can issue that much more debt because their debt load is going to be available to be paid out of current earnings, et cetera, and they can fund it very well, and they don't have to worry about this overall excess debt because the truth of the matter is it doesn't cost them much more. Unfortunately, that's great. That's not the fact. The fact is that they're also paying more in debt service, a lot more in debt service. If, in fact, earnings slow, if, in fact, we enter into a recession, if, in fact, things change dramatically, now, all of a sudden, that amount of debt that they have put out there, while they may have some cash on the books, which they could retire some of the debt, is going to cause a drag on earnings. The other thing that's a problem right now is, and where maybe some of the concern came from markets on Friday and last week, was that if we have an increase in yield, it makes the debt issuance much more expensive. Therefore, reversing what we just discussed, making share buybacks more improbable because they're not going to be borrowing all that money that they have been doing. Higher rates also make yields on stocks less attractive. Now, we're not talking about a big move here. We're talking about, you know, we went from the range, 1.4 and change on the 10-year to 1.6. Not a big deal, but we're at the top of the range. But more important is that we've had a few important players out there talking about their concern about the bond market and, in particular, a breaking point if the Fed comes in and they do something that is maybe surprising, which I would find highly unlikely. They've been so transparent, at least in the fact that they don't want to raise rates. I mean, that, you know, that they're not just going to surprise markets all of a sudden. But there was a great discussion on Bloomberg this week that I want to go through with you. Listen to this.
Double Line Capital's Jeff Gundlach commented in a webcast yesterday why this is not the right time to invest in corporate credit.
Credit risk, especially high credit risk, like emerging market debt and high yield bonds, doing really well, way better than stocks, interestingly, this year. And yet other parts of the bond market with substantially lower returns. This is a time period where I think corporate bonds are highly overvalued.
Now, to be fair, Jeff Gundlach has said this many times before. He's really, but let's get into a discussion from some other players that were being interviewed, that same discussion.
Joining us now with his take is Gershon Distenfeld, AB Director of High Yield and Investment Grade Credit. Gershon, it's great to have you with us on the program. Do you agree with that?
It isn't the first time I've heard it from him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he hasn't exactly been right in the past.
A few people feel like that this morning.
I think in general, we try and predict a little bit too much. I will agree with him, though. I think we're a little bit overvalued. And when was the last time you had someone talk about the market and say it's always cheap, right? It's always cheap. Everyone thinks the market's
cheap.
It's
always upside.
Yeah, it's always upside.
Let's just pause there for 1 second. What he's talking about here is a overvaluation in certain areas of the bond and fixed income market, not stock markets. But let's get back to what he's talking about.
But I think, you know, whether it's overvalued, expensive, means something very different in the fixed income markets in general and in credit specifically. We invest in mathematical instruments.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, we can sit here and debate what something should be worth. Ultimately, either a company pays you back or it doesn't pay you back. So the fact that maybe spreads are tight or yields are low just means you're going to earn less. Your returns aren't going to be. Historically, you've gotten almost 10% annualized return in the high yield markets over the past 30 or so years, mid to high single digits in investment grade bonds. You're going to get lower returns. But you could say that about a lot of asset classes.
Capital returns have been great in the bond market this year, but the bottom line is if you hold a negative yielding assets to maturity, you guarantee a loss. There are no returns of that. And Lisa Abramowitz, our colleague here at Bloomberg, who you know and love, in the bond market, it's called an Alice in Wonderland bond market, and we can bring up a perfect example of that. junk-rated Peugeot over in Europe with yields down to zero. Now, you can call it a mathematical instrument, or we can talk about fundamentals. Whatever way you look at that, that makes no sense. When does that change in a real significant way?
Now, again, you know, one of the big things he's talking about here is the whole environment that we're living in with negative rates, negative yields. And why is that? It's just not a mysterious thing that just occurred because of market forces. It's all about central banks. They're buying things and willing to buy things to a point that allows for interest rates to go negative, and they've forced it to that level. So I think that, you know, the whole idea is it's all about central banks. And until central banks stop what they're doing, you know, the truth of the matter is nothing's going to change. And I think this guest on the Bloomberg interview kind of talks about that a little bit.
Well, you know, if Draghi stops buying at some point, and that is going to happen, right? Maybe it'll happen tomorrow, 2 years or 5 years from now. We don't necessarily know. We're all speculating about it. That couldn't happen. But I think it's also important to recognize that a U.S.-based investor who goes and buys European bonds, Japanese bonds, actually can earn a positive yield.
Right.
When you hedge that back into U.S. dollars. And we're seeing, of course, the opposite for Japanese investors. You know, we think yields are low here. When they invest in our paper, when they hedge it back to yen, let's say, they're earning a lot less.
Now, I got to make a comment here. I really didn't understand this very well because the yen has been up 18% this year. Now, I don't know if he's talking about a longer period possibly, but if they hedge it back to yen, that's a really smart move because what's happening is they're gaining on the yen, the transaction between the dollar and the yen and the underlying paper. So they're getting no loss in that situation when it comes to that. Otherwise, the yen being up 18%, meaning if they held it back in dollar terms without hedging, they'd be down 18% in the currency transaction. So I'm not sure if he's talking short term or long term here. So don't get too confused and caught up in that.
Gershon, you have investment grade in your title. You also have high yield in your title. High yields have been going gangbusters recently. Where are you on high yields, and how concerned are you about credit worthiness, given where we are on the credit cycle?
Yeah, so I look, high yield's not just one market. It's, you know, so we could talk about average yields are 6.5% or so, but you aren't buying a lot of bonds at 6.5%. You're buying a lot of bonds at 3%, 4%, 5%, where the credit risk is fine. And again, you're just going to earn 3%, 4%, 5%, not 10%. And then you have stuff at 10 or 15% where some of them are going to be great opportunities. Some are going to end up defaulting. So I am worried. One of the things that I think is very important in this type of environment is not to constrain yourself to only one area of the market to generate income. You don't just have to buy high yield corporate bonds. You can buy emerging market debt, although I know Gundlach threw that in as part of it also. There are securitized assets in the mortgage space. It gets a very bad rap because of what happened during the crisis, but it's a completely different market than it is today. In fact, in our flagship high income portfolio, we have almost 20% of our portfolio in those assets. We think there's much better relative value there.
You talk about it not being one market. Let's take high yield, for instance, and take the bottom rung of that particular asset class, so to speak. The worst junk rated companies with negative outlooks, you will have seen this, Standard & Poor's Global Credit Ratings, putting this out. We're back to 2009 in terms of the number of those companies. Is that where the pain will be felt more acutely, given where pricing has gone to on these particular securities?
Now, this is an important thing to consider because this gen is talking about how, well, you're going to get 3%, 4% on some of these high yield and 15 or 18% on others. Some of them may default, some of them not. The problem is, when we're talking about high yield, talking about junk or below investment grade bonds, the problem has been that it's pretty interesting that we're finding 3 and 4% yielders. In other words, there have been so much of a requirement by some pension funds, institutional investors, and retail investors that are seeking out basically yield at any cost, at any level of risk, it doesn't matter, that they have been bidding up prices to a level that there is a significant amount of overall premium that's put into these positions. So while we're talking about those, think about it. When we're talking about those ones that are 15 or 20% yield, maybe they should have been really 30 or 40. Those are why they're defaulting. But the yield is much lower now because there's been such a drive into these and a requirement for the yield on these without a real concern about the risk. So, you know, consider that the high yield market is also distorted. And this is all because of the fact that we're seeing that central banks just won't stop. They're buying anything impossible, driving yields down so low that people have really no alternatives, and significantly distorting markets and overall underlying fundamentals of markets.
So look, I get it. There's going to be tremendous dispersion. That's what always happens late in the cycle. And you can't just blindly buy the market. If you look at all the previous crises we've had in the, you know, the financial crisis, the European debt crisis in 11, the taper tantrum in 13,
yep.
Energy more recently.
Now, from here, you would expect that someone in the bond market who is talking about their portfolio or the things that they manage and who's talking their book is going to say, hey, you know, just buy the dip. It's all worked out very well. And it has. You know, we saw that big drop on high yield when oil prices came in and then you just kind of went in and bought it as oil stabilized and high yield bonds came back very significantly. We saw that time and time again with various sectors of the high yield market. But listen to what he has to say now about the future. This is what I think was really key in this whole discussion, especially from someone who manages a bond portfolio, and particularly in the high yield area, and something to be concerned about, or at least aware of.
All right. If you just bought risk pretty much blindly coming out of that, you did very, very well. It's going to be very different this time. There's going to be a lot of dispersion. You're going to have things, you're going to have bonds that trade at 15%. They're going to have total returns of 30 or 40%. And you're going to have ones that have that you lose most of your principal on, negative 50% or greater returns.
Another form of risk is duration. And it's been thought that you can get higher yields if you go out the curve. You get a longer duration. Where are you on that at this point? Is that a smart move?
So we don't think so. We see a lot of people piling in, specifically for the reason I mentioned earlier. If you're a euro-based or yen-based investor and you invest, even more of our markets are at negative yields when you hedge it back to the home currency. So we're seeing those investors go out in the curve, and it's making that a little bit expensive.
So I thought that was a good summation of kind of maybe some of the concern that's in the markets right now in terms of risk of many of the more risky types of fixed income if, in fact, interest rates move higher, possibly if oil moves lower, and a little bit of the dynamic that went into possibly the psyche of what was going on last week. So we had interest rates that would possibly rise. We had Gundlach coming out with his warning. We have Rosengren coming out with his discussion. We know about all the other things about economics and earnings. But the big question is still, why this big nasty breakdown on Friday? What was it all about? Why? I don't think there's any one particular answer, by the way. I'm not going to just throw it out there. But I will tell you that we were long overdue for this. We know this. Come on. You know that we were overdue for some kind of correction here in a market that seemed to never want to go down. And there was something behind it that was very questionable. Something wasn't lining up. It's not the worst thing in the world. You need corrections to get rid of some of the excess. And we're not anywhere near a true quote-unquote correction, the official, as they say, the 10% drop in markets from a high, et cetera. But maybe we have what I think is more appropriate is a liquidity problem in markets. With so much stock being taken out of the market in the form of stock buybacks over the last several years, maybe there's a liquidity issue that's going on. Possibly also that this extraordinary move that we saw into ETFs over the last 2 years, into index investing, the move away from active management, actively managed mutual funds, actively managed hedge funds into index funds because, well, you know, markets just always go up. And if they go down, they just pop back up right after. Maybe that had something to do with this a little bit when there was finally some selling that took hold. That because the index funds, maybe some of the players moved out of them, causing further drop in markets because they're selling an entire index rather than an actively managed fund, which may have some cash so they can meet their particular withdrawals with the cash they have on hand, or possibly even sell a couple of the stocks that they want to trim some positions on, whereas an ETF is basically going to sell the whole block to come up with, you know, or what's going to happen is the whole block's going to sell when the position is sold. We also had a major technical breakdown. Look at the area of 2150, which was a very well-defined level of support and resistance in the S&P 500 cash index. When we broke that, if you notice, we did see a increase in the momentum on the way down at the 2150 area. Now, you know, I've had several conversations with clients over the last week or so, specifically related to the global allocations portfolios that we manage. And I told them, you know, we're light on equities. In some cases, we're the lightest that we'd really actually go according to having equity exposure. You know, where's the left-hand side on the range of where we like to see this particular sector, equities, small cap, large cap, mid cap. We think that long term it's okay. But you know what? In the near term, we were a little bit more concerned about this. I had a long conversation with a client and want to know if she should increase risk at this point. And this was probably a week ago. And I said, you know, it's not the time to do so right now. If you look at all the things that we're discussing right now in this discussion today, and you put them back and add them all up, the fact of the matter is, with a lot of headwinds ahead of us, we have the election coming. We have the potential for some Fed move or not in the September meeting. We have oil having problems, earnings, et cetera. It's not the time at this moment to increase risk. There will be a time that we will add to the portfolio if we do see a normalization and a repricing of markets, and we'll increase it again because, again, long term, we have some good faith in the markets long term. In a longer term sense, but in the near term, which is a different kind of discussion, there's a little bit of concern. And we know this in our managed growth portfolios that we only have about 45% equity exposure or so net. And why is that? Well, there's a lot of reasons why that is, but the fact is that we could not get stocks that met the criteria, and as such, it was just a normal process. We talked to a couple of different people over the last few weeks that were talking about how they have a much lower exposure to equities right now. So when we add this all up, probably ECB was a big issue last week. The Fed potential raising of rates was a big issue. Prices dropping and yields rising. By the way, you could look at shorting TLT or going long TBT, two ETFs that have the longer bond exposure as potential hedges against a upwardly moving yield curve. And then finally, just to mention, of course, we had North Korea launching and testing nuclear weapons last week. So that didn't help on a Friday. Didn't help the mood on this Friday to say, oh, everything's fine in the world. So we had a high volume day. We were working through the week with really no constructive move on the markets throughout the week. And for whatever reason, something broke. It wasn't a fat finger. We know that because it wasn't just quick and over. It was the whole day. Maybe it was a hedge fund that was pulling out. You know, we do see that there has been a significant amount of withdrawal requests from hedge funds, closures of hedge funds, and that will mean selling. Don't kid yourself and thinking that, well, all the selling will be absorbed by all these hedge funds that people are pulling out of. Now, they may be absorbed long term, but as the hedge funds are moving out of their positions to meet their quarterly demands for withdrawal, that money's not going to be necessarily deployed immediately because it's going to take some time for them to bring up their cash balances. And then once they hit the date that they're required to send out the money, they'll send the money out. So it's not like they're just selling. It's not like somebody's selling an active mutual fund and just buying an ETF, like within a one-day transaction. It will take longer for that to happen. And as we're seeing that various pension funds and institutions are reducing down their hedge fund exposure, causing hedge funds to sell, there may be something going on with that as well. Anyway, that's what's going on with markets. I know it's a long discussion, but I definitely wanted to talk to you about the concerns I have for the fixed income market and what we're doing for portfolios, just to give you some practical discussion of how we're positioning. The last year or so, we have been actually moving to a moving portfolios and successfully got them there, but kind of moved portfolios for the last year and a half into a shorter maturity, shorter duration type of fixed income exposure, and have been looking at continuing that process, reducing equity exposure in certain areas of the markets. And that has been, you know, the general move towards low duration, low maturity, a short maturity, and even floating rate bonds has been very successful. We have a small position in emerging markets, fixed income, and the fact that we have this nice blend has actually created a nice outperformance for our global allocations, against indices and against benchmarks. It's been actually a pretty good year so far. But anyway, the point is that we have been actively and very consciously bringing down duration, bringing down maturity, bringing down risk in the fixed income market with the base idea very simply. It's very simple. How much lower can bonds go? How much lower can yields go from here? If they go negative, I don't care. Because truthfully, we're not talking about a lot of money here. But on the other side, if there's a shock to the system, if central banks lose the confidence of all of us out here, which it seems to be happening, if they start going off the rails a bit and people are looking to cash out, and because of the lack of liquidity in the general market, because it's been bought up by either companies doing share buybacks or by central banks buying bonds all over the place, I mean, you know what? I'd rather be safe than sorry at this point. It seems a much better plan. And getting a decent yield at the same time. There's not much differential when you look at the big picture between our short maturity funds and something in the belly of the curve or longer. But the risk is so much higher. So if you have a portfolio that is chock full of bonds, by the way, whether it's high yield bonds, whether it is even in the longer maturity bonds, or maybe you don't know. That's probably a little higher level and percentage of us that don't exactly know what's inside that bond portfolio. I'm telling you right now, take a look. And if you want us to, I'm just putting it out there. If you want us to, we'll take a look at it for you. And I'll tell you, just go to the same place. Go to, just write me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you have a bond portfolio that you're concerned about and something that you want to take a look at to find out what your real duration is, what your maturities are, and what your options are, send me a note. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And do yourself a favor. Don't wait too long to do this. You may not be happy with the results. And if we're wrong, no harm, no foul. Because truly, it's not going to make much of a difference if we're wrong. But if you're wrong and you have the wrong setup right now, that may be painful. So ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Or just send me a note and we can kind of go through it and talk about it and see what's going on for you there. You can also visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com, of course, ask a question. We're going to have a couple of different questions that came in already from listeners. We're going to queue that up for next week. A question from Robert and Aaron that came in today. As soon as we put up that new place over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, go to the top, click the button, ask Andrew a question, and you can fill out the form for listener questions that will be answered on an episode upcoming. Of course, listen to DH Unplugged and check out all the things that we have to offer on the site, because on dhunplugged.com, there's a great stock trading game contest that we have between myself and John each and every week, John C. Dvorak, as well as we also have a game that we play with the listeners, giving away t-shirts and other things for those that come closest to the pin. And that's about all I have this week. I want to thank you for listening, of course, and listening and telling your friends about this particular show, making it so highly rated and played by many people around the world. We have listeners from all over the place. It's really great. Thank you so much for being there, and thanks for listening all these years. We're going to be back next week with a great guest, actually, we have online. I don't have the name in front of me, but I know we had a good guest because I was reading their information earlier. But anyway, we'll see you then. Have a great day. Enjoy your day. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.